I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. When you think of tales of the American frontier, chances are good Little House on the Prairie comes to mind. But the life of author Laura Ingalls Wilder went beyond her childhood homes. Today we'll learn about Wilder's later years. With her husband, she moved to the Missouri Ozarks. We'll hear about their lives there and the contentious relationship she had with her daughter. Then, you may have heard that the Cleveland Indians are retiring their controversial Chief Wahoo logo. We'll discuss the use of Native American imagery in Major League sports and ask what this change might mean for other teams. Later, Bill Brownlee joins us with this week's Local Listen. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. If she was still alive, Laura Ingalls Wilder would be 151 years old today. As it is, she lived until February 10, 1957, to the age of 90. In a series of 8 children's books published in her lifetime, Wilder recounted her life from early childhood to her marriage at age 18. Known collectively as the Little House books, they became among the most popular in children's literature right up to today. But the first story wasn't published until 1932, and they tell nothing of Laura's long life after she married Almanzo Wilder. What were the forces that shaped the writer, and what made her finally write the tales that had delighted readers for decades? You can find the answers in Prairie Fires, The American Dreams of Laura Ingalls Wilder, a biography that offers a detailed account of the writer's life and times. Caroline Frazier is the author of Prairie Fires and joins me now from the studios of KUNM in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And Caroline, welcome.
Thank you.
I think readers who only know Laura Ingalls Wilder through her Little House stories will be fascinated by the amount of context that your book offers. You not only provide an in-depth telling of Laura's life, but you open the door on her parents' and her daughter's lives as well. What made you take this on?
Well, I had grown to feel that while we all knew, or most of us knew, the fictional Laura quite well, that she'd almost been kind of loved to death in a way. And I just wanted to go back to the real Laura Ingalls Wilder, whose life was in a lot of ways even more remarkable than the stories that she told.
You know, one of the steps you took in researching this was the use of land and financial records to track the homesteading efforts of the Ingalls and the Wilders. How hard was it to find those documents?
It does involve a lot of searching and going to these places in some cases. And what you find is a lot of records that kind of reveal these small, in some cases heartbreakingly small, debts that the family incurred. And these debts accrued and eventually just made it impossible for the families to continue farming. And this, it turns out, was a real pattern in the Great Plains, that most of the small farmers that went out there, drawn by these promises that, you know, rain would follow the plow, were to find that they were grossly undercapitalized, that they just didn't have enough money to do what they were doing and didn't have enough resources to last out the bad years.
I bet you almost wanted to reach back in time and offer them a hand.
Yeah, and in fact, when you, you know, read the Little House stories as an adult, you almost feel like telling the family who is relatively well off in the little house in the big woods to just stay there because they would have been a lot better off.
I was going to say the Little House books tell this almost romantic tale of pioneer life, but as you're saying, it was tough. It was really tough. Charles Ingalls, you know, Laura's pa, was never really able to sustain the family by farming alone. Why not?
Well, again, they just did not have very good land to start with. I mean, you see him really searching around, trying to find a better place. But by the time he came along, a lot of the really good land in the Midwest that had enough precipitation had already been snapped up. And so land for him was going to be either too expensive or just unavailable. And so he keeps searching, trying to find a better place, eventually ends up after some horrible experiences in Minnesota with the grasshopper plague of the 1870s, he ends up further out on the Great Plains in Dakota Territory. And that was a cruelly difficult place to do what they call dry land farming, which is farming without irrigation.
So how many times did he wind up starting over?
About a half a dozen. I mean, you see, he goes to, you know, from Wisconsin to Kansas to, you know, Minnesota, Iowa, eventually Dakota Territory. But, you know, there's a lot of kind of, there's almost an aimless quality to some of these movements because they really were out of money. I mean, by the time they had lived through this grasshopper disaster in Minnesota, they just had very little resources left. And that's why Charles Ingalls ends up doing the homesteading thing of trying to get this quote-unquote free land in Dakota Territory.
I'm talking with Caroline Frazier. She's the author of Prairie Fires, The American Dream of Laura Ingalls Wilder. You know, all these places that you're referencing here that she wrote about, they all wound up lending themselves to Laura's writing. How good was her recall of those locations, you know, given especially how young she was?
Well, she doesn't really write the books until she's in her 60s, so she was casting back many decades. She was remarkably accurate in a lot of the details about how they, you know, built the log cabins and how her father made bullets and cleaned his gun and, you know, how her mother made cheese and all of these details of life she was quite accurate about. I think in a larger sense, though, she was really selecting details that really reflected well on her parents. She always said she wanted to write these books as a memorial to her parents and their values, you know, integrity and self-reliance and honesty. And in doing that self-selection, she really did kind of de-emphasize how hard life was.
You know, one of these places wound up greatly influencing Laura. You write, the family spent little more than a year on the Kansas prairie, but it shaped her temperament and outlook for the rest of her life. That year made her who she was. And I'm wondering how so.
Well, these were clearly some of the earliest and most profound memories that she had. She wrote about them again and again, and you see the incredible sort of depth of emotion that she had about that experience in Little House on the Prairie, especially these final scenes where she's watching the Indians ride away, as she calls it, and asking her father to get her one of the little Indian babies. And it's really an extraordinary and very strange scene in American literature that kind of encapsulates everything about their experience and about the appropriation of land from the Native Americans.
You know, poverty wound up being a constant in her life, and she was a hard worker. What were some of the jobs that she wound up doing in her lifetime?
Well, she begins working really at the age of 9, you know, in hotels, waiting on tables. She did a lot of work as a seamstress, making buttonholes. She was a teacher quite memorably for several terms. And that, I think, really did shape her outlook on her own ambition. I think she realized when she took on those teaching jobs, which she really didn't want to do, she was really afraid of doing that, didn't like living with strangers and in strange places. But when she took that on and succeeded, I think it proved to her that she really had resources within herself that she hadn't even realized.
Mm-hmm. So let's go to 1894. She and Almanzo, with their young daughter Rose, they leave South Dakota. They travel by wagon to Mansfield, Missouri, where they would spend the rest of their lives. What made them undertake such a long journey, and why Mansfield, Missouri?
Well, they were joining thousands of other farmers who had washed out after the so-called Dakota boom, you know, which brought all these people out there who then ultimately failed, as the Wilders did. They had a lot of disasters in Dakota Territory, lost a son, suffered a terrible illness that left Almanzo with a permanent disability, and their house burned down. And after that, there was just no way they could stay. They found Mansfield through one of these brochures, which promised that it was the land of the big red apple, and that they would find you know, prosperity and good health. Many of these railroad pamphlets were quite extraordinary sales pitches, essentially, for a particular region. But they did find a somewhat better life in the Ozarks. The climate was much more forgiving, even if the land that they ended up buying was fairly poor. And so they were able to eke out a living there.
You know, two events early on in Rose Wilder's childhood made impressions that never really left her. Tell us about the house fire in South Dakota, and then about the money that was supposed to give the Wilders their new start down in Missouri.
Well, the house fire, which was really the event that ruined the Wilders, occurred when Rose was really only, you know, two and a half years old. She would later claim that it was her fault, although I don't think that there's any evidence for that. And it was a really heartbreaking conclusion to the Wilders, you know, homesteading chapter, because this was a house that Almanzo had put a lot of time and effort and money into building for his new bride. And it was really supposed to be their permanent home. And it just started one day, probably from the stove, and consumed the whole house in minutes. And left them with virtually nothing. Hmm. Then they undertake this massive migration to the Ozarks in Missouri. And when they get there, Laura, who has hidden some money in a lap desk, discovers that it is missing.
Oh.
And this was a huge, devastating blow. This was money that they had worked for a couple of years to save, mainly by Laura sewing and Almanzo doing odd jobs. So this was, you know, an utter catastrophe. It would have, you know, set them on a path of homelessness and ruin. They, within a number of days, did actually find the money. It had just slipped down into a crack, but not before Rose felt that she had somehow been blamed for the loss. Whether that was, you know, obviously it wasn't true, and whether she felt those feelings, you know, no matter where that came from, or, you know, she seemed to feel that her mother had said something to blame her. It just left her with this lifelong resentment, I think, which may have encompassed much more than just that single event. But you certainly see their relationship was quite difficult for many decades.
I was going to say, you really can't tell Laura's story without telling Rose's, because they're just so intertwined, but they're so unlike each other. Describe their relationship.
Yes, they had a very tumultuous relationship, and they were sort of like, you know, chalk and cheese or something, because Laura is this incredibly careful, frugal person, and Rose would grow up to be what they called in Mansfield a bohemian, who had all kinds of outre ideas and questionable morals, according to the, you know, very conservative small town Baptist life. So they really clashed on a number of occasions, and yet they relied on each other in ways that kind of left no boundaries between them. And in some ways they were alike, because they were both quite tempestuous and very opinionated. You know, they were both quite stubborn. And so when they come to work on the Little House books together, you really see a clash of visions and voices.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking about The Little House on the Prairie. Caroline Frazier, the author of Prairie Fires, The American Dreams of Laura Ingalls Wilder. You know, we should also probably point out that Rose exhibited behavior that, you know, today might be described as, you know, bipolar or manic depressive. How self-aware was she of what she was up against?
Not very self-aware, I think. I mean, she certainly did become suicidal at various points in her life, and I don't think that she ever really recovered from the depression that she felt. And yet she didn't seek out any kind of help for that, even though she counseled other friends of hers to get such help. So it's very hard to kind of reckon with Rose's lack of insight a lot of times into her own behavior. And of course, later on, she becomes very conservative and is one of the women who is credited with founding the libertarian movement.
Hmm. You mentioned that Rose was so terrible at managing money. You tell of how she supported her parents at times, yet they often lended Rose money, just the opposite. How hard was that on Laura, who was, you know, always worried about the family's finances?
You know, I think it must have been very difficult for her. And unfortunately, we don't have very much at all in terms of Laura describing in her own voice what she thought about Rose or how she felt about how Rose handled things. So we're left to infer her feelings mainly from things that Rose wrote, which are themselves colored by her views. So it's a tricky relationship to untangle in a lot of ways. And the biographer, of course, is left, wishing that they had more material to work with.
Both Rose and Laura wrote professionally. Before the Little House books, Laura penned a column for a number of years. How did that happen? And what was her column about? And what was the influence on the rest of her writing life then?
Well, almost as soon as Rose herself entered the professional world of journalism, which was not very professional at that time, she was sort of a yellow journalist and worked in a way that combined fact and fiction, often in ways that weren't really acknowledged. But almost as soon as she starts that career in 1915, she is urging her mother to get on the bandwagon and make money by doing this. And so Laura quickly sees that there is some possibility of making extra money out of writing for farm women about such topics as, you know, how to raise hens successfully and chicks. And so she becomes kind of a advice columnist for a farm newspaper. But she was quickly so successful at that she was given her own column and encouraged to just write about whatever she wanted. And many times she would use the column to reach back into her memories and write about her father and her sister and various exciting events that had occurred in her childhood. And so that was really her first opportunity to explore those topics.
And to what extent did that lead to the launch of the Little House books?
I think that that had been a project that was discussed between Laura and Rose for years. And so it was always in Laura's mind that she wanted to write a memoir. And she did. That was the first major work that she undertook in around 1930. They tried to sell that as a serial to magazines. And when that didn't sell, Laura returned to an idea that she had some years earlier of writing for children.
And Rose was in this from the start, right? And what role did she play?
Absolutely. She was very involved in encouraging her mother to do this. She actually became kind of competitive with her mother and began writing her own versions of her mother's stories, which is quite an astonishing thing. And she also, you know, provided all the professional connections. She edited her mother's work quite heavily, sometimes revising things and adding some famous passages.
And drama, right?
Yes, yes, definitely. You know, and adding sort of these notes of patriotism to a couple of the books. So you can really see her libertarian values and language coming out in a few places.
So without Rosa's efforts, how likely is it that the Little House books would have ever seen the light of day?
I don't think Rose was actually a ghostwriter, as some people have suggested, but I think it's quite clear that we wouldn't have the books at all if it weren't for Rose.
Laura was 62, you've mentioned this, when she wrote what would become Little House in the Big Woods, the first book in the series. How popular was that book when it first came out?
It sold quite strongly for a children's book in the Depression, and was selected for the, you know, Junior Literary Guild and got quite a bit of attention. So it really got the series off to a strong start. The next two books that followed, Farmer Boy and Little House on the Prairie, I think may not have, you know, sold so well. And there was always a kind of feeling that they were a little bit orphaned, interestingly, because, of course, Little House on the Prairie would eventually become the most important book in the series.
To what extent did the books finally bring the Wilders some financial security?
Oh, they absolutely did. Although Wilder didn't become, you know, hugely wealthy for someone who was living, who lived most of her life in poverty and lived in a place that was in very straitened circumstances, she became very well off and secure and found a lot of comfort in her later years.
Hmm. Caroline Frazier is the author of Prairie Fires, The American Dreams of Laura Ingalls Wilder. The New York Times called it one of the best books of the year. Caroline, what a pleasure to have you. Thanks for sharing the story with us.
Thank you for having me.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll ask, is it time to drop the tomahawk chop? I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Tomorrow we'll hear how one local group is keeping alive the legacy of the Buffalo Soldiers. Also, we'll get a preview of the Farm Bill. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Yesterday, we learned how a business can be both profitable and fair, and which ones are doing just that. We also talked with some KC jazz greats about their upcoming performance with, get this, the Kansas City Symphony. You can hear those conversations and other previous shows. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. Well, the Cleveland Indians baseball team will stop using the Chief Wahoo logo on their uniforms beginning in 2019. The move is being hailed as another step in the right direction, but it's also being criticized for not going far enough. While the logo will go, the team name will remain the Indians. A lot of universities around the country have stopped using Native American nicknames, but at the professional ranks, the Washington Redskins are resisting changing their name, even though the pressure is on the team to do just that. Now a conversation about Native American images used as logos and mascots, and whether the Chiefs should reconsider a new name as well. With us, Brian Gordon is a KU assistant professor in the Department of Health, Sport, and Exercise Sciences. He joins us by Skype. Brian, good morning. You there, Brian? Cody Marshall is a Haskell Indian Nations University instructor of Indigenous and American Indian Studies. Cody, nice to have you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm glad you're there. Let me begin with you, Cody. Articulate for us why linking Native American imagery with sports teams is so offensive to some people.
Well, there's a lot of kind of documented research that's been done over several decades digging into this exact topic about how these images can be hurtful and they perpetuate the use of stereotypes, stereotypical images. The names themselves, in the case of like the Washington National Football Team, for instance, that would be a major one. And these different organizations like the American Psychological Association, the American Anthropological Association, others have done research to kind of determine how this impacts Native people today and how it has impacted them in the past. And it seems as though there is a lot of conclusive information and research out there to demonstrate that this can have a negative impact on Native youth in particular, especially when you consider that Native youth make up about one-third of all of the Native American population today. So those are some of the ways that it can be viewed as being definitely hurtful.
Well, given that, how do students at Haskell regard the controversy over, you know, say, the Cleveland Indians baseball team, and how is this registering with them?
You know, it's I kind of just posed that to one of my classes the other day, that kind of general question. And, you know, just like with any kind of group of people and any Native community in this country, it's kind of a mixed bag. Some people are happy about the choice to remove the Chief Wahoo logo. Others are kind of indifferent towards it. And there's you know, some that just haven't given it a whole lot of thought. So it's kind of that that mixture of people that you would kind of have on this topic, you know, in any kind of culture or community, basically.
So it doesn't sound like it's that hot of an issue.
Yeah, I think it kind of depends on who you're exactly speaking to, for sure. Within different groups, and even in my classes, for instance, one can have a totally different kind of makeup than another one in terms of how they're going to deal with these types of topics and issues. So it really kind of depends, basically.
So what do you make of the decision by the Cleveland Indians last month to let go of the Chief Wahoo logo? How big a step is this in your view?
It's definitely a step in the right direction. I think the complete resolution of it would have been for them to not only announce they were dropping the logo, but then to also say that they weren't going to continue selling it, which is kind of, that's kind of a problem in a way, because they're still going to keep the license and trademark on it. It's still going to be something that's going to be put on merchandise that people can buy. So it's definitely not going to disappear off of the landscape by any means, it doesn't seem like. The other kind of completion to this whole process would be to actually, I think, just change the name of the team as well in the process here, because it kind of raises its own questions. Well, why do you have to keep this team name? You're getting rid of this offensive logo. What is the purpose behind this now?
What's your sense of why the team won't take that step, Cody?
I think it's I think it really comes back to that age-old answer of money, and how there's a lot of money that are built into these sports franchises. And I think a team like Cleveland or the Washington National Football Team, for instance, they're concerned about their fan base, and they want to make sure that they're not going to make any drastic changes that's going to lose them their fan base, which basically equates into dollars for the team itself. And Cleveland has been making some very kind of small, steady steps over the last few years, such as kind of going to using the block letter C on some of their gear,
right,
rather than the Chief Wahoo logo, things like that. So they're moving in that direction, but it's I think they're trying to make sure they're not going to alienate any of those longtime fans.
Well, Brian Gordon, the KU assistant professor in the Department of Health, Sport, and Exercise Sciences, joins us now. Brian, you ready to go?
I am ready to go, Steve. Thanks for having me.
No, thanks for joining us by Skype here this morning. What do you make of the decision by the Indians last month to let go of the Chief Wahoo logo? Is it half a step too short, or what do you make of it?
Yeah, I think I've kind of characterized it as a small step in the right direction. Chief Wahoo obviously is, you know, a racist caricature cartoon image. You know, the reason I say it's a small step in the right direction is they're still going to be able to sell merchandise with Chief Wahoo on it. Also, this is not going to happen till the season of 2019. So it's not something that's going to be implemented, right away. And finally, it's not going to prevent fans from still dressing in headdresses, wearing Chief Wahoo, doing, you know, the war chant at the event site. So that's why I kind of characterize it as a small step in the right direction.
Brian, why do you think they didn't implement the change right away? Why waited another year for this?
You know, that's a great question, and I haven't seen any kind of clarity on why this is something that couldn't be implemented for the 2018 season. I don't know if it's a matter of kind of merchandise production and uniforms, and it takes time to make that change for
I suspect
game
that's
outfits.
Exactly where what it is, right?
Yes. Yeah, that's what I would think.
Yeah. Cody, why is this happening now with Cleveland? I mean, certainly teams across leagues have been criticized for this for years. So why now? Do we have any sense of that?
My thinking on that is it's a team like Cleveland, they see the writing on the wall. They realize that these mascots, these logos, images cannot go on forever, and they're going to gain more and more attention as time goes on. And I think maybe one of the big causes for that is really social media. And that's because now you can have these kind of campaigns against these types of logos on social media. You can get words trending on Twitter and things like that to bring people into the conversation. Whereas maybe a little over 10 years ago, for instance, you kind of had to rely on mainstream media outlets to cover this if you wanted to get information on it to a larger audience. And I think that now that more attention is being brought to this, and I think as Brian brought up a great point there about people are still going to be putting on a red face when they go to these games, things like that. And the last thing maybe these teams want to have associated with themselves is a hashtag on Twitter, Cleveland Red Face or something like that, that's going to draw attention to the problem of these names and logos and things like that.
If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking about the use of Native American images as mascots and logos on sports teams. Well, let's turn to maybe the hot issue here locally. Why are the Indians facing such pressure while, a team like the Kansas City Chiefs appears not to be? And by all means, I should point out that the Chiefs were named after H. Roe Bartle, a former mayor who was known as the Chief and not after Native Americans per se. But is there a difference here, Brian, that we should be thinking about?
Yeah, I think so. I think when you look at, Chief Wahoo and that kind of caricature, it's very overtly racist and stereotypical. And I think you can make the same case for the term Redskins as well. It's a dictionary racial slur. Now, when you talk about the Chiefs, it maybe doesn't quite have that stigma attached to it. And they really have kind of stayed out of the national debate about a name change. So I think it kind of has to do with the degree of what the imagery represents.
I want to get Cody's reaction to that, but I also want to invite our listeners in to our conversation. Is it time for the Chiefs to rename the team in the wake of all this controversy involving Native American imagery? Our number, 816-235-2888, where you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Cody, again, you teach at Haskell Indian Nations University over in Lawrence. Do you buy what Brian just said?
Yeah, I do. I think there's definitely something to that, and I'm not from the Kansas City area originally, so my knowledge is not necessarily complete in terms of how much the Chiefs have used, utilized different types of imagery over the years. It seems like from what I do know, it's kind of ebbed and flowed here and there from the 1960s forward, sometimes kind of during games using less, sometimes using more, things of that sort. So I do think there is something to that. And the way I've kind of thought about this ongoing mascot issue for the last several years is how do you kind of frame it in terms of a spectrum of offensiveness? On mm-hmm. one end, you could have the Washington football team, for instance, as the extreme kind of logo and name itself. On the other end, you might have, the Chiefs as being perhaps less offensive. But when it kind of comes down, what I kind of realize is that what it comes down to is that if it's still kind of on this spectrum of offensiveness, it's still ultimately probably offensive in some way or another. So you still end up kind of debating, splitting hairs on a couple of these items here and there, I think. And it always kind of leads to maybe one team being the exception to allow other teams to continue using their logos or images.
I was going to say, Cody, you go to Arrowhead today and fans still do the tomahawk chop, which is the, raising up and down of the hand like someone's throwing a tomahawk. And mm-hmm. That's been going on forever over here.
Right, and the Atlanta Braves are in that same kind of boat there as well, where that's kind of a common thing that you could see at their baseball games as well. And, that's your perpetuation of Native peoples as having, tools of violence, basically, and that's kind of perpetuating these harmful images of of who Native peoples actually are, I think, overall. And it's, you know, ultimately kind of spreading continued misinformation about historical representations as well as contemporary ones.
Well, Cody, is the tomahawk chop, is it offensive?
I would say yes, because it's the idea of Native peoples being on the warpath, right? That
right.
We were somehow always the aggressors in history, that we weren't the ones, you know, that we were the threat to the settler colonial society, which is actually the exact opposite of what real Native history, in fact, actually is. It was mainly people trying to defend their homelands, if anything at all. So this kind of idea of people being on the warpath, that's part of it. But then also, there's oftentimes a chanting. I don't know if they do this at the Arrowhead Games or not, but you get that kind of stereotypical Hollywood.
Yes, the answer is,
Indian
yeah.
Chant.
Mm-hmm. Brian Gordon from KU, do you think the tomahawk chop is offensive?
Yeah, I think so as well, for a lot of the reasons that Cody kind of already laid out, in terms of just creating this image of savagery, that they're savage warriors, that this group has that. It's very much a kind of a Hollywood characterization. And I think another important point is, you know, NFL teams are obviously in the mass media and have a lot of light shined on them. And for some people, this might be their main method of exposure to Native people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really, really problematic when that's the image that's being portrayed, and that's your kind of main your main exposure to Native people is watching the war chant, seeing people dressed up in headdresses, you know, painting their face red.
Right.
I think that's really problematic.
Well, Brian, a listener just emailed us with a question right down that lane. The listener writes, wouldn't eliminating all references to Indians take away the awareness that they are part of our history? Doesn't the name of the team honor the Indian culture? Please also explain what's correct at this point, Native American or American Indian?
Okay, I mean, I typically, when I talk in class and we're talking about this issue, I typically use the term American Indian. But I think the emailer's point is well taken. While on the one hand, there aren't a lot of mass media representations, you know, of Native people in society, you also have to keep in mind how are they being represented. So if they're being represented in a very stereotypical fashion,
mm-hmm.
Then that's also problematic. Even if it is a way to keep Native people, you know, in the conscience of society, if they're not being represented in the right manner, then I still think that's problematic.
Cody, over at your classes at Haskell, do you use the phrase Native American or do you use American Indian?
That's a great question. In my classes, especially in my kind of lower level first-year student classes, I talk specifically about terminology, and we go through all of the various terms, Indian, Native American Indian, Indigenous, and we talk about those terms, and we can deconstruct them and talk about the historical baggage that's tied into some of those terms. And ultimately, I use them interchangeably in class, but I like to have that conversation with students and get them in on the discussion so they can start thinking about what they actually want to use themselves. Because really for, you know, being at a place where the entire student body is Native American, self-identity, I think, is extremely important. And as long as they understand where these terms originate from, they can actually kind of make a better decision for themselves in terms of how they want to identify.
We're talking about Native American mascots. Is there a place in our society for using them, including at Arrowhead Stadium with the Kansas City Chiefs? Ralph from Olathe, you're on Up to Date, Ralph.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
Well, thanks.
Good. You correctly pointed out that when Lamar Hunt moved the team, he couldn't have the Dallas Texans, made it the Kansas City Chiefs. You had mentioned that it was named for Mayor Bartle, who was the chief. My question was about the Arrowhead logo. And that's, you know, a flint-tipped arrowhead, a Native American artifact, and whether the logo should be changed. And, of course, the name of the stadium should be changed, maybe have some naming rights and call it Cerner Stadium, but about the logo itself, and maybe if the fan base could be involved in a name change for all the teams, getting the fans involved in the change of the name.
Brian, what about the Arrowhead logo?
Yeah, I'm not originally from the Kansas City area, but I did know kind of the history of how the Chiefs got their name. It's something I've always wondered about, too, is if, you're honoring a former mayor and naming your team the Chiefs. Where does kind of Arrowhead and that imagery fit in? So I think that's really kind of a valid question if you're going to say, if you're going to try to say that this is named after a former mayor and to honor this mayor. I always wonder where does Arrowhead fit into this conversation as well?
Do you have the same question, Cody?
Yeah, I definitely do. And I think the caller actually brings up a good point, too, about really, you know, if these teams want to take the step in the direction of making a name change or changing their imagery and things like that, utilizing their fan base and respecting them and actually bringing them into the conversation and saying and kind of, you know, really leveling with them and explaining, we're going to make this change because of all of these reasons that have already been stated, and kind of explaining to them, but we want the fans to be involved to have a voice in what new kind of image the team is going to take on. I think that is actually kind of a solution to, I think, several of these teams' issues with these mascots and logos.
I know the Shawnee Mission School District on the Kansas side of the state line has faced criticism for the Indian nickname at Shawnee Mission North, and there's a reexamination going on there. But, Cody, I wanted to ask you for a little context here because you've looked at the history of Native American imagery. You know, how far back does this go when it comes to linking sports teams and consumer products, for that matter, with nicknames like Indians and Redskins and Chiefs?
Right. There's definitely advertising campaigns that go back to the late 1800s, for tobacco brands, specifically for Anheuser-Busch had kind of a Custer's Last Stand lithograph that they sent out to bars and taverns during the 1890s across the country to sell their beer that kind of depicted, this violent imagery of Native Americans. So there's a very long history there for sure. And at the same time, at the turn of the 20th century, that's when you really start to see the rise of team names having using nicknames or types of imagery of Native peoples for their teams, whether it be baseball or football or anything like that. And I think that probably coincides with this historical notion at the end of the 1800s, early 1900s, that Native Americans were considered at that time the vanishing race, because it appeared that we were dying in such high numbers as a result of the Indian Wars in the 1800s, disease being put on reservations, things like that, that we weren't going to be around much longer. So that whole notion of honoring, so to speak, comes right out of that period of time where we can present them to the American public and remember them in this way. Of course, we didn't vanish, which is a huge plus there.
So the naming after Native Americans was seen as a benevolent gesture?
I do think that there is part of that involved in this. If you look at like the Chicago Blackhawks, the hockey team out of Chicago, their team name originated, as far as the story that I understand is, from a military unit, the Blackhawks, which were named after the Blackhawk leader or Chief Blackhawk back in the 1830s. So that was also kind of that image of the warrior spirit that Native Americans supposedly embodied, and they wanted to incorporate it into this this team name as well.
Well, interesting stuff. We're going to have to leave our conversation there. Brian Gordon's a KU assistant professor in the Department of Health, Sport, and Exercise Sciences. Cody Marshall is with Haskell Indian Nations University. He's an instructor of Indigenous and American Indian Studies. Thank you both for a good conversation.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Steve.
Coming up, Bill Brownlee in this week's Local Listen. KCUR music contributor Bill Brownlee joins me here in the studio now, as he does most Wednesdays, to highlight a Kansas City musical act with an upcoming show. And Bill, welcome back.
Thank you, Steve.
Tell me about Julia Othmer.
Julia Othmer is going to have a musical homecoming at Knuckleheads on Friday. She is a former student in the Park Hill School District, and she's traveled around the world, and in the past several years, she's pursued her musical career, and she will release her second album later this year. But she's in town to perform at Knuckleheads, and then she's going to stick around for the Folk Alliance Conference the subsequent week.
Let's get a sense of what Julia Othmer sounds like. This is Hungry Days, Make Me Feel, a single from her forthcoming album, Sound.
Sound.
listeners won't get the full effect here, Bill, because we have to do some talking, but this song's got a slow build to it, and it really transforms itself. What do you like most about Julia Othmer's music?
Well, this is a melodramatic song, and as you say, it rises into a little miniature rock symphony and gets quite clamorous toward the end. But she is a extremely enthusiastic performer. She's dynamic, and this song reflects that aspect of her personality.
You know, the hook to this song is "Make Me Love, Make Me Burn, Make My Heart Ache." What's she singing about there?
She told me that, and I'll quote, that she thinks it's an anthem against apathy, that she intends to remind herself to be active in this life, to engage and experience the world, end quote. So she thinks in, she's a big picture kind of woman.
You know, she lives in L.A., but she claims Kansas City is home. Do I have that right?
That's right. Her parents and family still live here.
And she's going to perform this weekend at what, Knuckles?
Yeah, she is going to play at the Garage Stage, which is one of the bigger rooms in the Knuckleheads complex in
right.
the East Bottoms.
It's now a complex, isn't it?
It sure is. There are multiple stages, and it's quite a remarkable enterprise Frank Hicks has going on down there.
She's a pianist, but she'll have a band with her, right?
That's right. She'll be joined by Kansas City-based musicians like Jeff Porter, who plays with Bob Wackenhorst and the Rainmakers a lot, bassist Johnny Hamill, and drummer John Floyd Whitaker.
That's Bill Brownlee talking about this week's local listen pick. That's Julia Othmer. She performs this Friday down at Knuckleheads. Bill, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Missed humming along as we chatted about some of our favorite TV theme songs? Well, you can find that and our other conversations in podcast form at kcur.org/uptodate. You can find us on Twitter. We're at kcuruptodate. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow we look at what to expect in the 2018 Farm Bill, and we'll hear from a local group that's helping to sustain the legacy of the Buffalo Soldiers. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Claire Verbeck. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.